Уважаемые участники, гости форума будущего,
dear participants, guests of the forum, Forum of the Future 2050, we are continuing the panel discussion, Wars of the Future, Gamification of War. The session will be moderated by a blogger and Russian military journalist, a public figure and expert, Yuri Padalyaka.
Здравствуйте, спасибо. Я модератором.
Hello, thank you very much. I just became appointed as a moderator 5 minutes ago because unfortunately our moderator got into a traffic accident. He's fine, but he couldn't be here on time. So this is going to be the first time I'm acting as the moderator. So we are gathering our participants. People are probably still enjoying their tea and coffee. And we're going to wait a few more minutes for everyone to assemble, and then we will get started. Although I see that we're already behind schedule, but considering that one of the speakers is not going to be present, I think we are going to be doing fine on time. With your permission, let's begin. I will introduce our speakers, who will be joining us today. Unfortunately, Alexander Baradai is not going to be able to join us. So the next speaker is Kirill Malafeev, CEO of Ruscifra.
Karakhanov NS.
NS Karakhanov, chairman of the International Center for Combating Crime and Terrorism. And Nikolai Sitnikov, director of Quadcom Interactive, LLC. I will begin, and then I will transition to my opening remarks. Those of you that are monitoring the situation at the special military operation may have observed that it has changed dramatically. I have been talking to the people on the front line, and they are saying that if you were not there for half a year, you need to get retrained because the situation has changed. Dangers and perils have changed, and threats have changed, and you need to get retrained to get involved into a new reality. And even the instructors that teach at the proving grounds, they have to be aware of the most recent changes that are happening at the line of contact. Things are changing at lightning speed. And that also applies to digitalization of war. It all started in a standard way in 2022, in the spring. A lot of military equipment, convoys of tanks, battles, successes, failures. And the drones were more of an exception than the rule. A year passed after that, and the drones became the factor that would decide the battles in most cases. So it's now the drones, primarily FPV drones, aerial ones, act as reconnaissance vehicles, and they can be a decisive factor in battles, and they account for 80 to 90% of damage. And the opposing hostile parties do not see each other, but they see each other on their monitors or on their tablets. They can see the face of the enemy, that they are, taking death to or an injury to. What's important to note about this is that people in this new type of war are treating it in a different way. They perceive it differently. I've spoken to a lot of people on the front line. The FPV operators, people going mad, literally. I'm not going to give you the names of some of the pilots, operators that are well known in the media field, and they had really gone mad. And I don't know what they're going to do when they are going to be in this peaceful life. And that's a new challenge that our country and the rest of the world will have to digest somehow and learn to live with this and work on safety issues right now, to arrange a hit using a drone is not a problem at all. You're not going to be able to find any proof or any clues. Plus, people that will get back from war, those that are used to killing with a click of a mouse, they have overstepped that line between a life and death. That's what changes a man forever. Well, in the past, if you were attacking or defending, you could smell the powder. Now you don't do that. You just look at the monitor. You are killing an individual on the other side, the first, the second, the 100th, the 1000th. And to get back to a normal psychic state or psychological state is impossible. People will have to learn to live with that. And we will try to discuss some of these aspects in this discussion. And then maybe look out into the future and see how this war might change further. What are going to be the wars of the future, so that we would better understand the challenges that we face and how to respond to that. And with your permission, I will start not as a moderator, but as a speaker, one of the speakers who will be making a brief presentation. I would like to, be brief, because the next session will start at 12:30. We will need to be done here at 12:15. So we have 10 minutes for each speaker. Please stay within that time limit. And if someone, gets carried away, I will stop them. Please don't get offended. So, wars of the future, what are they going to be like? It is clear that there will be less and less of direct shootouts and contact on the front line. You've seen it from reports that it's all under a very fast scheme. You need to cross a distance very quickly that separates where you are to the location where you need to be in such a way that the enemy would not be able to respond. And if it does respond, then the damage to you should be minimal. As soon as you get there, then you dig in. And you do it in such a way that the enemy would not be able to repel you from that location. And most likely, the enemy would not be there because it would have been already shot at by the FPVs and the artillery. And so the enemy soldiers and the enemy troops are no longer there. Sometimes it happens that there could be some direct confrontations, but that number is going down. Even the defending enemy is not going to be shooting at you using a grenade launcher or a machine gun, but it would be more important for them to, keep to a certain location on the map and just ensure that their presence is seen. That's the goal of the infantry that is there. That is changing every half a year, that task is, but that's what it is right now. So, and we are acting in the way I've described, and the enemy is defending in the way I've just explained to you. And going forward, there will be even more automated systems, including the land-based drones, unmanned vehicles on the ground that will be making those attacks. We'll be trying to secure a particular location on the map, and that would then be backed up by live infantrymen. And after that, that particular location would be considered to be taken sometimes. It can be a case where there's a settlement where there are no troops present, no man's land, and fights over that no man's land could take up to 2 weeks. If you try to occupy it, then you would be pushed back, and the same goes for the enemy. So these are the kind of, back and forth actions that can drag for weeks. Each of the sides is now developing the tactics that would enable it to make those back and forth actions or swing action something that would be in their favor. So it's a war of logistics to ensure that the enemy could not concentrate enough forces in a particular location and then storm an enemy's redoubt. And that could, you know, extend to a location that covers 10 to 15 kilometers of distance. No movement should be made possible so that ammunition could not be provided to the troops, water or food, and therefore the UAVs are going to be used to deliver food and ammunition. And the same goes for the wounded ones that would be carried out from the battlefields using unmanned vehicle. Of course, man plays an important role in the rear guard areas. They will be in charge of, you know, manning these events and managing these events. So a major challenge to all of us, including our educational and training system, which is unfortunately lagging behind, is to catch up with what's going on. We need to have enough experts in these fields, trained professionals. I know this firsthand. There are a lot of drone operators who are not really well trained, and the same goes for the enemy. And they die during the first battle they get involved in because they are the priority target at the contact line. And it is these groups of people, similar to the snipers in the past. So they are the priority target for the enemy at all costs. For example, we would know that if we know that there is a good good unit of drone operators, that we would just, you know, send as many UAVs there to ensure that they're all destroyed, because every operator of UAV could cost us hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. A drone operator or pilot of a drone is a very dangerous job, and if you're not qualified enough, and you need to train these people nowadays, not just to hit the targets, but to mask properly, hide properly, and ensure that the information security and follow the rules of what we call information hygiene. Otherwise, they will be able to find who you are and kill you. I've spoken with some of the aces on the battlefield. We are in touch, and this is a very IQ-intensive job, and a very well-trained individual is needed to do this job properly. If you know just how to, you know, operate a mouse, that's not a problem. A gamer like this, if he doesn't have any other skills, is not going to be, or is unlikely to become a good drone operator, because it would be, or he would be killed in the very first fight. Because they may be used to the fact that in game world, they can get reset, and that kind of dumbs or numbs the sense of security or self-preservation, and that can play a trick on you, and people suffer, and people incur wounds and die. It's not a game. It's not a virtual game. There's no such thing in war. This leads to real death. And sometimes you just don't notice that the death is approaching. It's blackout immediately. So we do not pay enough attention to these things. And then to win this war, and perhaps other wars, because the world has entered the era of a serious upheaval, and the space is becoming more virtual, and that adds to the changes that are happening to the world. In the end, this means that we need to rethink our society. And I'm not just talking about virtualization of war, but also the relations between men. And this is going to change dramatically in the next 10 to 15 years. And after that, we'll be finding ourselves in a new space. And those of us who are young enough will see all of that, and we need to be prepared for that. And that completes my talk, and I would like now to give the floor to my colleague. And I will be reading the name, because I just became a moderator a few minutes before the start of this session. The next speaker is Kirill Malafeev, CEO of RusCifra. And I would like to ask the first question to him to start the conversation. Okay, let's talk about the UAV operators. Many of them are used to living in the virtual space, you know, moving the mouse and not understanding the real danger. How are they going to live with that? What do you think is going to, you know, drive their lives on the front line and behind the front lines and so on? Please, the floor is yours. Yes, thank you, Mikhail. The first thing I would like to start with is that you're absolutely right. A man that comes out of a virtual place is not ready to that sense of danger that he needs to learn to feel. But at the same time, it's very simple. Once you become involved in war, they understand that it's important not to die in the first battle. After the very first blast, they become aware of the danger. You cannot train this easily. You cannot prepare an individual for this during a training class that they go through when they learn how to operate a UAV. But the operator's course takes about 100 to 120 hours, depending on the type of the drones and the type of the operator. And may I disagree with you that you can not take a well-prepared, you know, virtual world individual. That's a bad idea. I didn't say it's a bad idea, but I just said that they didn't have enough good skills. Absolutely. These are the skills that are very important. And in the class for training the UAV operators, I think that is something that is included in the curriculum before people get to the front line, because initially they are in classrooms, and then once they've gone through the training class, they do some training flights at the testing grounds, and only after that they start, you know, really fighting. It's very important to ensure that they have a good sense of reality, the UAV operators. If you only see your enemy through the monitor, you've never seen the eyes of your enemy, it's very hard for you to understand when you are killing the individuals. And if you, you know, read the literature on this topic, it's really easier when you think that this is a game. I wouldn't even be afraid of this. I would add new rules to these games for the operator. They would know that once they've, you know, gone out to the front line virtually, they are in danger. And if they are 100 kilometers away from the front line, all you need to have is the Wi-Fi module and the integration of that Wi-Fi module with the control panel. And that also applies to the fiber optical driven drones. All you have to do is a connection to that location, and you can be in a safe place. And, you know, deploying the drones with that Mavics or the, you know, the 5-inch ones, you still need to deploy them, and that's when you are the most vulnerable. So you need to learn how to move. So the operator is transmitting, is broadcasting their commands. So you need to be at a distance to be safe. Let me also say that we don't have Russian-made simulators for UAVs. The ones that we're using are either Ukrainian or American-made. Right now, we don't have good simulators for UAVs that we could use for training. I don't understand how we can deal with this problem, because in order to start using something within the military, you would need at least a year for something to be implemented. But why? If the simulators are working, why do we need a Russian one? Do we really care whether they're made in Russia or not? I mean, for the operator. I understand it's good to have something made in Russia. Yes, I agree with you.
Yes, I agree with you, but if we want to adapt that for our own purposes or for our own types of the UAVs, this is not possible because, as a rule, this is not an open source software. So it's foreign made, and for instance, we have took that as a prey, but let me suggest my own topic on that issue. This is something that I'm very much knowledgeable. That's about the development. The problem that lies there in terms of the software development for the UAVs, I have a question to you and to other colleagues who are joining our discussion. Development of any software has to be done for the whole army. Otherwise, you will never be able to deploy that. You'll be able to deploy that only in certain units. But the development, in my opinion, within the state standard and within the public procurement is not possible. This is why ever since the beginning of the special military operation, we didn't have any UAVs because the program code is not been ordered by the Ministry of Defense. Once we have some nuts or some bolts, then it could be ordered, but as software is not been ordered by the Ministry of Defense. Similarly, after that war, we, as those who contribute to the military life of the country, will understand what we need, that not only the hardware is needed, not just the number of UAVs may make us the winners. I would agree. Unfortunately, the philosophy, the mindset of the top brass in the general staff leaves much to be desired, and those who follow my blog there now, and I usually cover that topic on my blog. What you have said is true not only for the software developers, but it is true for the whole philosophy of life in the country. Because the top brass, the commanders, have at least to know how it all works. I have to know that until today, even the top brass do not understand how the UAVs work, and the enemy unfortunately advanced very much in that sense, and they are not afraid of making experiments. And Madyar, a person who is a real specialist who created that from almost scratch, was appointed to the commander of UAV forces, and our top brass do not understand that, unfortunately. I think that we have to cross some red line. And answering your question, I hope that I did that well. Something I would like to close my piece of contribution. We all know how the UAVs have been operated everywhere. So Discord used to be used before, and therefore the information from every UAV is being transmitted to the staff. Every soldier is afraid of being responsible for UAVs because if a UAV costs about 35,000 rubles, it's no problem. But once it is more costly, then the people would be reluctant to be in charge of that, to be responsible for that. Once actually we solve the problem of responsibility, will we be able to use more sophisticated drones? Well, I'm not a pessimist. I know that such things have been developed and have been implemented, but not thanks to, but contrary to. Sadly, within the whole system of the army, such things cannot be proliferated, but out of despair, people have to resort to that as well. But unfortunately, the top management of the army have to be modernized, otherwise we will lag behind that cluster. Even if the UAVs are good, even if the software is good, but if we do not implement them the right way, the efficiency of those actions would be very, very low. Should I have any questions or anything to add? Kirill, for instance, asks a question, and we'll be able to elaborate on that, and if not, let's move forward. Okay. I welcome everyone. Thank you so much for your time, for coming. A few words about the development, software development, I mean. We assume, we believe that very soon all those military pieces of equipment would stop working. For instance, some software is no longer operational in Moscow and in Russia. Some time ago, our colleagues from the DPRK from North Korea, for instance, we communicate to them. So they have drones, they have equipment, but they have shortage of software. But we, on the contrary, have the software. We speak about the war of the future. The war can be good in a sense.
Она хорошо тем, что сейчас все раскрылось.
That everything has been disclosed, and what used to be kept in secret now has been disclosed. In a sense that we, all the guises have been lifted. We know what countries are at war and what intentions they have. Now we can analyze the intentions, and we can clearly see what they want. In that room, I see my friends from Europe, and yesterday we were talking to one another, and for instance, there are blackouts in Europe, and I said, why? Just and they say that they want to put the blame on the Russians, so they cut off electricity, and the European newspapers write that, as usual, the blame has to be put on the Russians. And my Center for Combating Crime and Terrorism is something new. We're just 4 years old, and at the moment we are developing the CCTVs, AI-driven. So the main idea is to provide for the public order early identification of security issues and supporting the social stability both on the territory of the Russian Federation and in friendly countries, because our center cooperates with all the friendly countries such as Iran, Azerbaijan, North Korea. Such a software was not available before. We have necessary hardware. But step by step, we are phasing out foreign-made products, solutions, and hardware. As I said, very soon they would be no longer operational in Russia. The rumors say that the foreign equipment doesn't work properly. The moment is opportune to make our own software hardware. And therefore, we now embarked on the security threats monitoring and developing that. So I pass the floor to my colleagues. Thank you so much. Apologize. May I ask one more question to Ines? Look, you are countering terrorism and crime. And I'm confident that your center should also be in charge of new technologies, I said in my presentation, new technologies. And for instance, look at the most recent attacks against our airdromes, strategic airdromes. And technologies are being used very actively for that. Are you using any solutions to counter such attacks? Well, that's a very good question. We know that Europe now is developing such mechanisms, and by the way, Interpol is lagging behind in terms of such solutions, and recently we heard that Interpol now is proposing some AI-driven solutions. Well, such solutions have already been put in operation. These solutions are available, but now we'd like to present that to the general public. Unfortunately, Russia's image abroad is not so good, and this is something that we have to promote. Therefore, we decided to develop an open source version, technologies addressing these security problems. Why those technologies failed on the attacks against those strategic airdrops? And last year, for instance, I visited Sakhalin, and there was an event dedicated to such technologies and software, hardware there is very good. And certainly we cannot do without the AI, artificial intelligence. It is assumed to become a rapid threat assessment and decision-making system, helping us to identify the targets and destroying them if they are potentially dangerous. I wonder just whether these solutions are integrated with your solutions. I do not know whether I would attend that exhibition this year or not, but technology looks very nice. I saw a prototype with my own eyes last summer, and certainly I would be keen to see whether they progressed in a year's time. Do you have any integration with such a system? We don't have such solutions, what I said. This is just in the pipeline.
Программа обеспечения. Вот знаете, вот дрона из Ирана, когда поставили, да?
Once technologies were supplied from Iran, Shahid drones, you know, they would not be operational, but for the Russian satellites. I would not say that Russia is lagging behind in terms of technologies. But we need a more open source solution, but certainly I will bear in mind your words. Well, actually, I didn't say that Russia is lagging behind. The whole world is lagging behind. Yeah. End of July, I think there would be another exhibition, another event, and I recommend that you visit that, you attend that to see what they're doing there. You will see with your own eyes how technological it could look like in future. It would be a very useful experience. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was Ines Krehanov, and next I would like to pass the floor to Sitikov Nikolai. And to trigger the discussion, let me ask a question again to continue my presentation. The society of the future after the special military operation, when our guys return back home, and you know that many of them now are capable of killing, looking at the screen of the gadgets. What can we do about that? Well, let me touch upon the previous topic. The war is being waged in cyberspace. We are fighting for the minds of people, and I will speak about gamification as well. The topic of war has always been present in the fiction movies and in games and movies impact the minds of people much more. For instance, once you read a book, you only read the words, and on the movies you see the actors, the emotions and surroundings, and games, apart from these things, also engage a person directly into the warfare. Therefore, the perception would be much stronger. How games portray the image of a war? You know, the shooters. That's a very well-known and the simplest type of a game, when a protagonist alone or single player or multiplayer would fight against the enemies, and you can clearly see who is good and who is evil. And if we make a comparison to movies, that would be Rambo, Independence Day, such American movies. And the question is, who is setting the narrative? That's the developer who sets the plot. That means that it's all about the country that has developed that game, or other online games, where you don't have a clear differentiation between good and bad. The narrative is defined by the players. There is another type of games that are being ordered by the military, and the very first game was developed in the year 2002. And what was the country that developed a game ordered by the military? Sadly, that was the United States. What was the goal of developing such a game? To train future warriors. No. Well, actually, it was about recruiting the rookies. Does it have anything to do with the gamification of a war? I do think so. Next type of games. This is when a player acts as a commander. In tactical games, that would be a commander of a small unit. And for the player, it would be important that his subordinates survive in different missions and to do what they are supposed to do because they acquire certain skills, they develop their knowledge, and the missions and the games are a far cry from a real war. We just see a battlefield and you can shoot, you can move, for instance, the characters, and once it is wounded, still it can run around. I have developed a concept of a game of our assault soldiers in close contact with our officers, with the carrier military. And the very concept was about bringing that game closer to the real warfare. And in the course of our discussions, we came up with the conclusion that such a game may be used as a kind of initial military training for the school children, because, well, for instance, there would be some real wounds, and that would require real medical help. The second conclusion was that such a game can be used for training the military as a simulator of tactical operations. Again, this is back to the topic of gamification of wars. The fourth type, that's about strategic games, when the player would assume the role of a commander-in-chief and would be in charge of detachments or units and components or even countries. What we can do in terms of the narrative or actually presenting the content, for instance. There are games where you can play on behalf of any country but the USSR. This is actually how the image of the country is being portrayed. And we know that many simulators are being created for the armies of the world, and such strategic simulators could be used as a simulation for the commanding officers, for the top brass. This has been done online, virtually, but the capacity of such a simulator would be much better than in conventional games.
We've already spoken about the simulators and the FPVs. It is a really topical issue because we mostly use foreign-made simulators for training UAV operators. We don't know whether there are any backdoors in there or exploits. But if there is a connection to the internet, we don't know what this will lead to. And if we are talking about FPV drones, the types of drones that we know about are in the hundreds in terms of their type, different types. And so we need to develop a comprehensive program for complex simulators where you could set the parameters for the drones of different types, and also introduce some other parameters such as the weather conditions and whatnot. And we need to refine the methods for training future drone operators. And if we can go back to the historic image of war, about 2 years ago, a game was released. That is taking place during the civil war in Russia, And the main characters are the white Czech troops. They're going back home. And who do you think are the baddies and the goodies in this game? I think the answer is obvious. The white Czech troops are good ones, and the Russians, regardless of whether these are Bolsheviks or Russian civilians, they are bad. So we are to decide whether they are good or bad. We need to decide it and to portray it that way. Another example, the Red Army is retreating and is burning down Russian villages, or would blow up bridges with on the way of their retreat. The gaming community was really indignant, and they wrote back to the developers. I'm sure you wouldn't guess what they the developers said. They said the following. There is the Solzhenitsyn book, and that's the way this was written in that book. He's your writer. That means that this has to be true. And this is why I'm focusing on this, because games do not run on a separate track. They are in the same space with other sources. In a similar way, they participate in developing this information bubble around the individual. People live in such an information bubble, and they are under the impact. Games can change this bubble, they can burst it. And what do we need to use? That's something we need to use. And what are the aspects that games have? Number one, propaganda or information influence. Secondly, it's something that helps teach civilians about what is associated with warring. And thirdly, using gamification for training the military personnel, something that has an immediate effect. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can I add a couple of things to that? Regarding the goodies and the baddies, I wanted to say a few more things. Right now, in the world, things are so bad that the number of good people is going to grow, because God's plan is in action now, and this plan will end with good things happening. And that has to be a very good motive for us, or would serve as a good motivation for hoping for good people to appear. But a few words about the digital war and the information war. And I would use an example. Who benefits is the key question. Here's an example of who benefits. You know who that person is. It's the head of the Kiev-based regime. Why does he benefit from that? But this individual multiplied his riches, increased his riches. Some articles say that he has even outstripped Elon Musk as the richest man in the world. And he's got all of his assets in cash. There's not a single individual in the world who has that much money in cash. So this information war benefits people like him. So what I'm driving at is this. When we talk about drones, sometimes you don't need to, you know, bomb people out with drones. It's sometimes enough to put posts on the internet, in YouTube, and have interviews. Sometimes it's even more effective and interesting, and it gets better results both for them and for us. That's how it is. And by the way, I wanted to tell you that at our center, we have an information and analytical department. There was recently an incident with the head of the political party. Turkey essentially is a friendly nation, and they wanted to connect an attack on a head of a party with Russia. And so they were claiming that there was the Russian footprint there. the Russian hand was at play there. So the relations between Turkey and Russia are currently at a good level, but somebody doesn't want that to be the case. And so the newspapers portrayed that in a bad way. If I could say a couple of minutes, I could spend a couple of minutes on this. Yeah, just briefly, because we don't have a lot of time. So we published a report. We view such events not from the standpoint of crime, but from the lens of how this serves to control people's perception. What this means, time, place, goal, and target in an attack are never chosen, you know, by chance. Sometimes we get confused when we watch TV, and incidents like this are non-standard. So the location of the attack was non-standard. That's the Atatürk Cultural Center in Istanbul, which is the heart of cultural heritage of Turkey. Here's what the message was: in the heart of the culture, we can take you out, we can shoot you. That's the message. The time of the attack, that was after the 19th of March, as Turkey was, you know, rebounding from political chaos. And the choice of the target was such that it was the individual who was, you know, aspiring to become a leader of the country. So it was not just political, but symbolic. This enhances the political and psychological impact of the attack. And these people want to create this perception not just in the Turkish people. They want to augment this by implying that this is something that's related to Russia. Very often such political attacks are not meant to kill someone, but to develop resolve. It is something, as we would call, an asymmetric political operation. The goal is to cause shock and make people lose their sense of self-confidence. So be very careful whenever something is presented to you on YouTube or on the internet. We need to look at whatever is presenting, is being presented to us from all angles. Why and who benefits? I agree with you. Thank you. We need to think about all of this in today's world in particular. And in conclusion, please allow me to sum up our discussion. It is clear that a contemporary war is going in all different realms, information, social, political, and others. And any state that needs to win in this war needs to have defenses in all these streams, information security, information safety. And I totally agree with Nikolai's statement that we need to develop our own games so that our people would consider to be on the right side of history and not follow the point of view that's imposed on us by the Americans. Some of the younger people were thinking that we were baddies because that's how it is. By default, we are baddies. So we need to be protected against terrorism, and that's a threat that is quite present. And we saw that we are behind in some of the tech areas. We are assembling our own FPV drones using Chinese parts, and that'll be the case for at least a few months, if not years. And our leadership needs to realize what is happening, how this is happening, and how to address that. We need to keep on updating and upgrading our systems, and our country can only win this fight if we address all of these issues. And with that, I would like to declare this session over. Thank you very much to all of you.